Just before Ninakawa passed away, the Zen master Ikkyu visited him. "Shall I lead you on?" Ikkyu asked. Ninakawa replied, "I came here alone, and I go alone. What help could you be to me?" Ikkyu answered, "If you think you really come and go, that is your delusion. Let me show you the path on which there is no coming and no going. What are you doing after this?"
"Many pardons, Wolf-sensei, but I'm not sure I understood the last part of the koan. Why would Ikkyu say, 'What are you doing after this?'"
No, that was me. I was asking you, what are you doing after this sesshin?
"Is that a different koan? What am I doing after the sesshin? Nothing, right? Because there is no after the sesshin, right, Wolf-sensei? There is only now, and now, and now, and now."
"Look, no, forget all that. I was just asking, do you feel like doing something later? Maybe go out for calzones or something?"
"Wolf-sensei, what is a calzone?"
"Well, it has an outside and an inside."
"But the attainment of full enlightenment recognizes no inside or outside. All is one."
"You know what? Forget it. I was thinking, you know, we've been sitting on these cushions for hours and my knees are killing me, and I don't know, I thought we could go for calzones, a couple glasses of Cabernet, and then see what leads to what. But I'm not in the mood anymore. Being a Zen master is killing my love life. But listen to this show about how that's not always the case. And now, even though the mountain becomes the sea, the dry cleaners cannot find his pants. Colin McEnroe."
"Yeah, that actually is my koan. Even though the mountain becomes the sea, the dry cleaners cannot find my pants." Let me just tell you a little something about this show. And it's a show, first of all, it's a show that we had kind of this working title for. We were calling it The Dark Side of Zen. But I think that's misleading, and I wouldn't even want you to get the idea that that's the only place we're going today. We are going to talk about some of the ways in which Zen Buddhism, you know, counterintuitively, because in so many different ways, particularly for people in the West, Zen Buddhism is where you go when your old religious connection is broken somehow, right? You're a Catholic, you're a Jew, you're something like that. It's not working anymore, yet you still crave some kind of spiritual life, and you go to Zen Buddhism because it seems so much less encrusted with harmful traditions and patriarchy and misogyny or whatever your problem was with your old religion. You have this kind of latent assumption that Zen Buddhism, it just seems like a purer, more connected, more enlightenment-focused religious discipline and spiritual path. So you go there. And so it's counterintuitive to suppose that when you go there, you're going to run into some of the same things that you thought you were fleeing. But that does happen sometimes. And we are going to talk about some of the times and some of the ways that it's happened, both in terms of, well, you're going to hear right at the beginning a conversation about a sex scandal that is not atypical, a sex scandal that is kind of, in fact, rather typical of sex scandals that have rocked Buddhist communities here in the West. We're also going to talk a little bit about the nature of or the relationship between Buddhism and militarism in certain circumstances. The most prominent one would be during World War II. And in fact, our guest during that time is Dr. Brian Daizen's Victoria, who is going to wake up at some ungodly hour in Kyoto, Japan, so he can talk to us about this. But, you know, towards the end of the show, and it's one of the main reasons that Dr. J. Michelson is one of our guests, I want to talk about sort of the ways in which some of these lessons that are still being learned and absorbed, because even the connection between militarism and Zen Buddhism is an ongoing one. You can look at what's happening in Myanmar today and see another example of that. But the ways in which all of this kind of allows Buddhism to learn and grow and evolve. Dr. G. Michelson is one of our guests today. His most recent book is called, I don't know if it's the most recent one, but it's called Evolving Dharma, Meditation Buddhism and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. He talks a lot in this book about kind of how there is a new Western Dharma, a new Western way of engaging in Buddhist teachings and engaging with Buddhist teachings that in many respects is poised to learn from some of the mistakes we're going to talk about today. So I just don't want you to get the feeling that we're here just to explore everything that can possibly ever go wrong with Buddhism, because that's not what we're here for. But in order to get into what we want to talk about. We're going to have to talk about that a little bit anyway. Our number is 860-275-7266, which in case you feel that we have strayed off the Eightfold Path, which we probably will from time to time, 860-275-7266, or if you just have a question. We're going to begin, though, our conversation with Mark Oppenheimer. He's the religion writer for the New York Times. You've heard him on the show many, many times. He directs the Yale Journalism Initiative. He's the author of many books, several books, and he's got a new e-book, Predator on the Upper East Side. This is what's called a Kindle single. You can only get it from Amazon, and you have to get it on your Kindle. And it costs $2.99, which is less than most calzones, just to sort of link it back to the introduction. So I think I've properly introduced Mark Oppenheimer. So Mark Oppenheimer, this story that you tell in Predator on the Upper East Side is the story of one Zen community that really over decades absorbed and tried to deal with the sexual activities of its guru, of its primary teacher. But I'm sure you can do a much better job of nutshelling your own Kindle single than I'm doing.
I will do my best. I should say, by the way, there's a Kindle app for all sorts of smartphones and tablets. You don't actually have to own
right.
a Kindle. And people should know that in general for Kindle singles. It's a lot of great long-form journalism that's being published by the Kindle market. Edo Shimano was born in Japan, came to Hawaii in the early 1960s. He was sponsored by a man named Robert Aiken, who had been a POW in a Japanese prisoner of war camp and had learned Zen Buddhism there and had come back to Hawaii where he was native and had started practicing Zen Buddhism. He then sponsored this monk whom he'd heard good things about to come over in, I think it was 1962. And almost immediately, Edo Shimano, while taking some classes at the University of Hawaii and leading some Zen sessions, began, it seems, seducing women. There's good reason to believe that two of them had mental breakdowns because of their encounters with him. And within a couple years, Shimano was off to Manhattan. He was out of Aitken's hair. And Aitken had, there are notes of that Aitken knew exactly what had been going on and was glad to be rid of him, but he didn't want to tell anyone what had happened or the real reason that Shimano was off to Manhattan, because he didn't want to destroy the reputation of Zen Buddhism, which at the time was largely unknown to people in the United States. So Shimano goes to Manhattan, New Year's Eve 1964, and basically pretty quickly takes over the Zen Study Society, which was the great Zen center in Manhattan. It had been founded by D.T. Suzuki, the best-selling Zen teacher who had taught at Columbia. And then basically, you know, to wrap up, from 1964 till pretty much the present, was one long march of Shimano's womanizing. I've talked to over a dozen women who had sexual contact with him, in many cases greatly unwanted. I should say they were all of age. These are not scandals of statutory rape or molestation. These are scandals of predatory seduction, womanizing, pressure brought to bear on people who didn't want to cooperate, in some cases groping and other kinds of force being used. And it's only – and this was an open secret in the elite world of Upper East Side and Manhattan and Brooklyn Zen Buddhist studies. Absolutely open secret. It was well known. But he wasn't fired until 2010. So my ebook, The Zen Predator of the Upper East Side, explores how that could possibly be.
And in fact, in that sense, I mean, it mirrors a lot of other stories that we've been told. That there are, although, as you say, everybody that we talk about here is of age, and everybody is, people are at different levels of consent.
Right.
But you know, it mirrors some of the stories about the Roman Catholic Church, at least in the sense that there's a lot of buck passing, and there's a lot of looking the other way. There's a lot of kind of hoping somebody else will deal with this, or just deciding that the damage to the institution, damage to the school of thought, to the spiritual practice, will exceed the benefit of actually dealing with this problem, and therefore people decide just to move forward.
And there's something especially nefarious in the fact that here you have a Japanese tradition which is highly patriarchal in Japan, where the Zen teachers historically are men and the monasteries are all male, not in every case but largely. And it's brought to the United States, it's brought to the West, where a lot of women get involved thinking we're going to make it a more egalitarian place. Then they end up being preyed on, kind of emotionally tortured in some cases by this man. And then they have a dilemma, which is that if they – and there are these horribly sort of painful, heart-wrenching notes that you find in letters where the women say, if I spill the beans on him, I will drive women farther away from Zen and it will be even more patriarchal. So in other words, they feel that if they stand up for themselves and rat him out, that they will actually be reinscribing the all-male nature of it because women will stay away. So they basically stay silent to allow women to keep coming to practice. And then these women end up victims as well. So it's truly pathological and very sad.
Let's add to this conversation Jay Michelson, who does see this thing a slightly different way in some cases. And I should say that Mark Oppenheimer was the one who really insisted that Jay Michelson be here. Jay Michelson is, I think I said, associate editor of Religion Dispatches, and the author of 5 books, most recently Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. He's a practicing Buddhist. And Jay Michelson, reading your book, reading Evolving Dharma, you know, I get to a certain point in the book, and it's almost like, hey, Oppenheimer, tell me something that I don't know. You go into this yourself. You talk about how, and you mentioned Shimano, the person that Mark's writing about, but this long series of other scandals, or at least other instances of Zen Buddhist teachers having sex with their students, which we can decide how much of a scandal that is or isn't. I guess the first question is, how much should anybody care about this? How big an issue should it be, particularly within the world of Zen Buddhism?
Well, I think it is actually a fairly significant issue because it's not just a couple of obscure teachers who no one's ever heard of. I mean, really, some of the leading Western Zen teachers, Sasaki Roshi, Maizumi Roshi — Roshi is just the honorific term for a Zen master — are implicated in these scandals. And I think it's not just an aberration, you know, here or there. It begins to look systemic when there are so many teachers who are implicated. And I think, you know, there are plenty of spiritual leaders who have sexual relations with people in their congregations or their students, but the secrecy and the abuse makes this, you know, totally indefensible. There's no way. It's not as though you went to one of these centers and there's a sign on the wall saying, no, you may have sex with your teacher at some point. These were vulnerable students in particular, and Mark's book really details that, how Shimano Roshi would really prey on the most vulnerable.
Although, Jay, one of the things that you deal with in your book, I mean, you really do sort of describe this as something of a gradient. And on some parts of the gradient, some of the women, whether they're having sex with Shimano or some other teacher, don't necessarily feel abused or exploited. I think one of the terms that you use in your book is sort of sex positivity and sex negativity. I mean, is this always a negative if you are a student of a Zen master and you're having sex with that person?
Well, that's what makes this so complicated. That I think we're accustomed to certain categories coming from our own culture of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and just the idea that we would even be possibly talking about a teacher-student relationship as somehow being okay probably is shocking some of the listeners right now. But it is exactly as you've described. A lot of the women who've had these relationships not only don't feel abused, but they feel like it was a positive part of their teacher-student relationship. Some of those women went on to become teachers themselves. So there's a broad diversity of responses. As Mark said, some of the women who Edo Shimano Roshi had affairs with regarded it as abuse and felt that they were coerced, and others had a very different reaction. So it unfortunately is not – it doesn't fit really the neat categories, I think, that we're used to from kind of traditional Western context, which have different notions about what the appropriate boundaries are between teacher and student.
Go ahead, Colin, if I may – that's true. I mean, Jay's absolutely right, and he's very good on this subject in Evolving Dharma and in his work generally. However, there's sort of two ways to look at this. One is from the point of view of the teachers, and if you're talking about someone like Sasaki Roshi in Los Angeles or Shimano Roshi in Manhattan, people who, you know, some have argued had dozens, and we don't have proof of dozens and dozens, but, you know, let's assume a Zen master has had sex with dozens of women. Inevitably, some of them won't feel exploited, right? I mean, you're talking about so many women in some of these cases that for some of them it will be a sex-positive experience, and it may be a Buddhism and spirituality-positive experience. And I didn't find any of those in the case of Shimano Roshi, but I found them along a whole sort of continuum of levels of comfort with what had happened. So yes, you will find – it is not the case that every woman will feel that she's gone through some sort of psychological rape. On the other hand, if you're looking at it from the point of view of the Zen master, if he is at all enlightened or if he at all cares about how he treats other people, I mean certainly for Shimano, he knew that at least some percentage of these women did feel they had been psychologically tortured really, and he never stopped. So what Jay's saying can be true while still offering absolutely zero excuse for the ongoing behavior of someone like Shimano.
You know, we're being
–
Go ahead, Jay.
Mark and I both were debaters in high school. He wrote a book about it, so we do like to do that. That's the case, and I think we do have this naive notion about what enlightenment is supposed to look like, that it's going to be some, you know, pacific, non-sexual, Yoda-like figure who's going to, you know, who's free of any mistakes in his life. And in the Zen tradition in particular, that's not actually what enlightenment means. I mean, it's a very specific thing. What enlightenment is, it has to do with a sort of intuitive grasp of some of the fundamental nature of reality. And that doesn't mean that you're going to be good at racing cars or good at interpersonal relations or good at doing radio interviews. It's one particular kind of human development that they focus on in that tradition. And, you know, this is why I do think, without being a rosy optimist about it, I do think that some of these very painful scandals have, I don't even want to say a silver lining, because that doesn't, I don't want to justify what these women had to go through. But there is a positive lesson to be taken from it, which is about not idolizing our teachers and not thinking that they're anything more than what they are, which is advanced at a very particular kind of thing.
You know, in our third segment, I really want to explore that last part. One of the things that Jay says in his book is that he kind of thinks the guru-centric model of Zen Buddhism is going to implode of its own accord. But I want to get to that in the third segment. But Jay, I want to sort of stop you there. And here I will, you know, exhibit my absolutely pathetic, you know, curbside understanding of Buddhism and say it has always struck me as something that is not without doctrine, and if I, what pathetically little I understand about it, includes this notion of the Eightfold Path, which includes notions of right conduct, which includes, the way that I understood it anyway, notions of right sexual conduct. And it feels a little bit like a dodge to sort of say, well, that's not what enlightenment is, and that's not necessarily what an enlightened teacher is. You can't really judge them by how well they drive a car or do a radio interview. I feel like there are ideas within Buddhism that do include not exploiting people sexually. But as I say, of the three of us, I know by far the least.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, within Buddhism, it's a big thing, right? And there are many, many different strands of Buddhism and kinds. And it's not a coincidence that we're only talking about Zen Buddhism here, which comes from a very particular and patriarchal Japanese tradition. Some of the, you know, I'll take an extreme actually from a non-Buddhist example. There's a Hindu teacher named Ramesh Balsekar who was active for many years and had numerous affairs with his students. And because his kind of theology, if that's the right word, or cosmology was, you know, everything is one and everything's kind of illusion, he actually was the straw man that Marx sets up in his book. He says, well, everything's one and it's all illusion, so it doesn't really matter. I'm not really having sex with you, am I? And it's a little bit just like the teaser to the segment, you know, with the what is a calzone. There are people who take that teaching very seriously.
Well, Shimano among them. I mean, the straw man, it's not a straw man because Shimano tried that with some of his students. That sort of your reality is behind a veil and none of us really knows. I mean, it's not like one guy who's tried that. And, you know, again, this isn't to disagree with Jay, but it is to say that if you wanted to find a tradition that might allow you to twist its teachings into a kind of sexual predation, you could choose pretty much any tradition and you would do it differently in Catholicism. And as Jay and I both know, you would do it differently if you were at Yeshiva University and you were an Orthodox rabbi, right? But there's a way to do it in using Zen Buddhist teachings as well, and specifically in Zen, where you do spend so much time in meditation and then these sort of brief meetings for teachings. And it is historically guru-centered. So I don't think it's such a straw man, right?
Well, you know,
I once wrote a poem literally after retreat because I had a crush on one of my fellow retreatants. You know, that said, if you're nothing and I'm nothing, how come you won't sleep with me? And, you know, fortunately, I wasn't in a position of power, right? I was just another student writing kind of a love letter that I never sent. But it is the case that the notion that everything is either illusion or one or emptiness that is a notion that can be really abused. And I think that's why you find in almost every tradition, including Zen Buddhism, a lot of rules that are meant to sit around that. And so this was a case of someone grossly violating those other rules, while still, I think even some of the women who he abused might even maintain, you know, he still has some kind of enlightenment or something like that. Confounds our categories, I think, of what wisdom is supposed to look like.
Let me just grab a call here. One of the things this conversation is missing is the voice of a woman. But we actually have Lisa from New Haven right now who has her own very Zen-informed perspective on this. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I'm actually practiced with Shimano for several years, not on a personal basis, but just attending his events. And I basically, when I found out about the scandal, I thought it was a great thing because it allows Zen Buddhism in the U.S. to sort of break away from Japan, so and sort of become a little more westernized in that sense. I mean, I think, you know, there's nothing intrinsic to Zen Buddhism that lends itself to sexual abuse, but this is an opportunity to sort of push away from Asia.
I want to get you to refine that a little bit, Lisa. In other words, what you're saying, and I think it's very similar to what Jay Michelson is saying in Evolving Dharma, is that if you can see the way that this model can not work when one person has too much authority, then it allows for the evolution of a more Western style of Dharma in which authority isn't invested so much in one teacher.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it was a bad combination of these Japanese teachers coming from almost a medieval system, many of them in the 1960s moving to the U.S., and there's this total clash of free will and free love and guys who've been locked up in monasteries for decades. So I think, you know, now we can sort of move beyond that sort of embryonic stage and really make Zen our own.
Mark Oppenheimer, I'm going to swing this back to you for a second. This is something you explore a lot in your Kindle single, Predator on the Upper East Side, which is that, I mean, I'm getting a tweet right now. By the way, we're tweeting or being tweeted at WNPR Colin. I'm getting a tweet from Hanging Hills that says, Western institutionalization of pretty much anything tends to lead to abuse and corruption within it. So that's one take that people with a cursory knowledge of this story might have, that, oh, you take something that's really pure in Japan, you bring it over to the West, you introduce a lot of other things to it, and before you know it, you've got Jimmy Swaggart Roshi. But that's not really the story you're telling here. You're telling a story similar to what Lisa's saying, that in the East, actually, there might have been ways in Japan, there might have been ways to contain this and not so much
over
here.
Well, you know, I only know what I hear. I mean, I'm not a practicing Buddhist, and Jay has practiced in a couple traditions, at least. I mean, he's a much deeper practitioner of spirituality than I am. But as a journalist, what I hear from people is actually that's just an idealization of Japan, that in fact the Japanese system has its own corruptions, has its own pathologies. They were somewhat better at containing this particular kind of disruption because the monasteries tended to be sex segregated, again, with some exceptions. And there was also a tradition that, you know, the monks and priests and abbots could go over the next hill and visit a prostitute if they wanted, or could take a mistress. So there were systems in place. I mean, Jay makes the point in a piece he wrote at the Daily Beast that, you know, one analogy might be the Japanese business person, the businessman in Japan, who we know there's a kind of different sort of cultural don't ask, don't tell that applies in some middle class Japanese, you know, business communities than would be accepted here in the United States. But I don't think it's like, well, it comes to the West and then it gets corrupted. A better point to make might be that a lot of these teachers came over from Japan in the 1960s and walked right into sexual liberation America. I mean, if there was ever a time when you could get away with this sort of thing and could find willing partners of both sexes, it would have been the late 60s into the 70s, and that's exactly when they were building their sanghas.
And so Jay Michelson, I mean, this is sort of what Mark's kind of describing. It's sort of like you have somebody like Shimano coming out of System A in Japan, entering System B, a much more democratized and heterogenized Buddhist environment in America, and maybe exploiting it, maybe not handling it too well, maybe taking advantage of that democratization to sort of to partner up with a lot of different women. And what you're sort of arguing for is System C, you know, a third way that somehow or other steps past this particular moment.
Yeah, I think we're in that awkward in-between stage. You know, everybody, both Lisa on the phone, and also thank you, Colin, for naming the lack of gender diversity in the conversation up until that point. You know, both Lisa on the phone and Mark are correct. You know, this idealized vision of, you know, Japan, as I mentioned before, that, you know, everything was good over there, and then it came over here, and it was, then that became a problem. That's not right. You know, there are all kinds of, you know, really horrible stories. We'll talk about militarism later on, but also around sexual abuse. And there were institutionalized forms of appropriate sexual activity, both heterosexual and homosexual, incidentally, some of which we might think are okay, and some of which we would see as very exploitative, that were in place. And then it's right. You bring someone from a traditional context like that into the middle of the sexual revolution, and you see that today. You know, when I go traveling in traditional non-Western societies with female friends who might walk around in a tank top, and that would be fine, you know, not known about an eyelash on the streets of New York, but that's seen as an invitation to sexual advances in some cultures, just because they're simply not used to that level of that kind of dress or that kind of appearance. So, right, we're in this in-between stage where hopefully what Lisa talked about, the caller talked about a minute ago, we can kind of get over this fetishization of the exotic oriental teacher or something like that, and see both Western and Eastern teachers as human beings who may have something to offer, but are no more and no less than that.
All right. We're going to grab a quick break here. We're going to come back to all of this. We're going to come back to the whole idea of Western Dharma and maybe even how it gets past this moment where there really have been kind of a profusion of stories of this kind, stories in which esteemed Zen teachers took advantage of that position sexually. But we also want to look at a sort of another phase. Jay just alluded to it, this sort of whole question of militarism. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back to that with Brian Victoria.
The girls come in droves and they land at your feet. No need to spend money like those other guys. Zen boyfriend, the bullet's on your side.
All right. As I said, I should say a couple of things again. One of them is that, you know, we are looking a little bit, spending a little bit of time in some of these segments today, looking at some of the darker moments of Buddhism. But we're not here to besmirch Buddhism in that way. And we will be spending quite a bit of time towards the end talking about, you know, ways in which Buddhism evolves beyond these troubling moments. But when this idea was first suggested by Mark Oppenheimer as a result of the book, the new ebook he's got out, this Kindle single, Predator on the Upper East Side, one of my first thoughts was what I understood as an admittedly mediocre history student in college, which was that that during and before the outbreak of World War II, the leaders of the cabinet in Japan and the military regime identified very heavily with Zen and infused their own actions with a lot of Zen precepts. That's about exactly how much I knew. I knew that it was also necessary to loosen the grip of Zen in order to even achieve a peace cabinet and try to end the war in some way. I knew those things, but I guess I didn't know about the work of our next guest, Dr. Brian Dyson-Victoria. I envy Dr. Victoria because he is a visiting fellow at the International Research Center for Japanese Studies in Kyoto, Japan, which is one of the most beautiful and wonderful cities in the world. I don't envy him because I think he's up right now at some ungodly hour of the morning. I'm not sure. What time is it there?
5 a.m.
What,
to be exact.
Okay, so it's a terrible time to be awake. You know, your work, especially your books, Zen at War and Zen War Stories, and right now you're writing a book on Zen terrorism in 1930s Japan, you know, they sort of completed the circle in a way that I didn't know about. One of the things that you studied and wrote about, that you researched and wrote about, was the role that actual Japanese teachers, Japanese Zen teachers, teachers who were heads of the most prestigious schools of Japanese Zen Buddhism, kind of made Zen doctrine available for militaristic thinking. And I'll let you pick up the story and tell it your own way.
Okay, well, thank you for the invitation to be on. You've had a wonderful conversation so far, and so let's see if we can keep at it, except that we don't have much time, so
okay.
I'll try to be as short as possible. But when my book first came out in Zen at War, came out in 1997, there was an American Zen priest by the name of Josh Baran who was really shocked by it. Mm. And he came to Japan, and he interviewed one of the leading Zen masters here. And he asked him, you know, did Brian Victoria write? Did that really happen? Did people really say these things? And the Zen master said, well, we Japanese don't like to talk about it, and so forth. And he said, well, but was it true? And he said, well, they didn't really say, you know, they didn't really go as far as Brian was writing. He said, well, what did they do? And he said, well, he said, you've got to understand that for we Zen priests, our relationship with our master is more important than our relationship with the Buddha or with his teachings. And therefore, we Japanese Zen priests are never going to criticize our masters.
Well,
and I think that's one of the main problems that we're dealing with here, whether we're talking about the so-called sexual scandals or militarism. And that, I mean, you've already alluded to it earlier in the program, and that's basically guru worship in which the master can do no wrong, and therefore whatever he says, and there are a few she, but mostly whatever he says goes. I know of one master who told his female disciples to disrobe in order to prove that they weren't attached to anything, including their clothing. So when it goes that far, I think we've got a real problem, and I think it's not really a question of, something's happened to Zen, something bad, or maybe even something good has happened to Zen when it came to the West, that these problems are here in Japan, and they've just been transferred in a different way when they've been introduced to the West.
You know, a lot of your writing has to do with what you call violence-enabling mechanisms within Zen, which can be found in all religions. In fact, a lot of the writing you do, it would be pretty easy to extract Zen and Zen Buddhism and substitute Islam and talk about the ways in which Islam has been used, you know, to justify violence and fatwas and terrorism. And
let's not forget Christianity.
And Christianity, sure. I mean, they're there everywhere. But I think for a lot of people who have a very casual understanding of Buddhism, this is very counterintuitive. I mean, they almost equate Buddhism with peace, with with a kind of tranquil enlightenment. The idea that there could be a violent kind of Buddhism is a hard thing for people to understand. But you know, in your writing, you talk about the way it was really intrinsic to the thinking of Japan before and during World War II. Say a little bit more about that.
Okay, let me give you a couple of examples. First of all, and you've already alluded to it, one of the most difficult things about this whole problem is that you can take doctrines. For example, let's take the doctrine, the Buddhist doctrine of no self, which really means that there's no permanent or eternal self or soul. All right. Now, that on the surface, that doesn't seem to be violent or an enabling mechanism for violence at all. And yet you have... There's a famous Zen master in 17th century Japan by the name of Takuan, and he had a famous swordsman disciple. And his disciple was a little concerned about the fact that he was going out there with his sword on occasion and killing other folks. And he asked, Takuan, what do you think about this? And Takuan says, well, look, there is no self, all right? Not really. There's nothing eternal, unchangeable. And so this is an exact quote. He said to him, the one who kills is empty, his sword is empty, and the one who is attacked is empty too. Thus, the one who attacks is not a person, and the sword that strikes, let me see here. Hold on just a second. The sword that strikes is not a sword, for the one who is attacked is just like cleaving in a lightning flash the breeze blowing in the spring sky. So here we have, because there's no permanent soul, because ultimately from that point of view we are empty, then when you kill another person or you are killed by that person, nothing's really changed because the emptiness remains. Now you move that to World War II, and you have, for example, here is a quote from a Lieutenant Colonel Sugimoto Goro, who was a god of war and was a very dedicated Zen practitioner. And this is what he wrote. He says the reason that Zen is important for soldiers is that all Japanese, especially soldiers, must live in the spirit of the unity of sovereign and subjects, eliminating their ego and getting rid of their self. It is exactly the awakening to the emptiness of Zen that is the fundamental spirit of the unity of sovereign and subjects. Through my practice of Zen, I'm able to get rid of my ego. In facilitating the accomplishment of this, Zen becomes, as it is, the true spirit of the imperial military. So what you see is that there is this, you know, the classical connection then moves seamlessly into the military sphere.
You know, one of the things that did shock people or trouble people about your work was that, and Mark earlier in the conversation alluded to D.T. Suzuki, who was probably the most recognizable teacher of Zen Buddhism in the United States for many, many years, and was the founder of the Zen Studies Center that Mark writes about. So this is a very revered person, and although there were other schools of Zen Buddhism with Japan that maybe had been a little bit more prominently associated before with the intense militarism of Japan around the time of World War II, maybe not so much Suzuki, but you brought him in with your scholarship into this conversation. Say something more about that.
Well, that's it's a very complicated story, but for those people who are interested in it, let me just quickly say there is an online journal called Japan Focus, and I've written a number of articles even recently, and we have two more coming out, and they're on the relationship of D.T. Suzuki with the Nazis, believe it or not, in World War II Japan. And this is, again, a totally unknown story that even I hadn't known about until, basically the last year. And so he's a very complicated person, and it's unjust even for me to say his relationship with the Nazis suddenly makes him sound terrible. As I said, very complicated, but I would urge people who are interested to look at all of the... There are people who are defending him. There are people like myself and others who are saying there are questions about him. You need to look at the whole picture. But one of the things I can say is that it's interesting. He was actually opposed to war with the United States. But when you check out why, he said... America is a very powerful country, and he had lived in America for more than a decade. He said, America is a very powerful country. He said this in 1940, and he said, if Japan attacks, we're likely to get beaten. And so you can take that as an anti-war statement, or you can take that as a statement of common sense that you don't go to war with countries that are likely to conquer you.
You know, we're talking to Dr. Brian Victoria, Dr. Brian Daizen Victoria. It's 3:44 in the morning in Kyoto, Japan, where he is right now, and we're going to let him go back to bed pretty soon. But I want to get into one last thing, because I think this is something that does permeate or at least proceed historically out of World War II and into the present moment. And in some of your scholarship, you've looked not simply at Japanese Zen Buddhism, but even at the Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama in situations where it's either the us or it's them, you know, that kind of sense. Well, either we're going to be exterminated and lose everything, including what we have to offer the world as Buddhists, or we're going to fight back. And you see it now in Myanmar, where there are at times what appear to be fairly brutal acts of violence perpetrated by Buddhist monks against a much smaller Muslim population there. So it seems to me that one of the things that does surface in your work is occasionally it is the argument that, well, somebody's trying to do away with us Buddhists or take something away from us. In that situation, we do have an argument for striking back.
Well, you know, you can certainly argue that point. However, the point I would make is that when we look at the life of the historical founder of the faith, his country actually came under attack. The first time he went to the battlefield and he was able to talk them out of it. The second time he went, he saw that the people who were about to attack his country, that there was nothing he could say to them, and he didn't you know, he was a warrior himself. He was raised as a warrior. He was the warrior class. But he didn't, you know, bring his followers and turn them into soldiers. He stepped aside, and his own country was destroyed. The city-state, let's not call it a country, the city-state was destroyed. And I think that's a pretty powerful statement that at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, that at least the founder of the faith refused to take up arms, even to defend his own city-state.
All right, Dr. Brian Dyson of Victoria, we're going to let you go back to bed or settle in to watch the sunrise in Kyoto, whichever you choose to do. Thank you so much for joining us. We are going to move ahead to a break. When we come back, we will talk about sort of what gets learned, what gets absorbed from some of these stories that we're talking about, and what is the bright new third way of Western Dharma.
If you see the Buddha on the road, you must kill him. If you see the Buddha on the road, you must kill him. He's no guide and he's no god. Even blind, he's no guide dog. You must kill him.
Jack Kornfield wrote, "After the ecstasy, the laundry. But I took ecstasy and wound up watching my dryer for 16 hours. What am I missing here?" Today's show was mindfully produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Garrett Connolly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Leonard Cohen. For photos, links, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff sitting with their heads shaved and chanting for 30 minutes about molecular gastronomy, visit our website, WNPR.org. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro. Tomorrow, a show about Norman Rockwell with writer Deborah Solomon. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, somehow or other, I'm going to have to put down all these Zen Buddhism books and pick up the Norman Rockwell book, and it'll be quite a gear shift.
He was a Zen Buddhist.
Good. I haven't got to that part of the Deborah Solomon biography. Mark Oppenheimer's with us. That's who you just heard. He's a religion reporter for the New York Times. His new e-book, his new Kindle single, although you don't have to have a Kindle to use it. You can get apps for all kinds of things. You can probably watch it, read it on your dryer. I'll read aloud to you. Yeah, Predator on the Upper East Side. Jay Michelson is also with us. He's a scholar and writer, author of 5 books, including most recently Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. He's a practicing Buddhist. Mark isn't. So let me just begin there. I want to come back to that song and the famous line, if you see Buddha on the road, kill him, because I know it sort of fits some of what we're talking about here. But, Mark, I want to sort of start with you and just sort of say, what do you think the takeaway is from the story that you're telling about this this leader of the Zen Studies Center, this man who, if you're just tuning in, had sex with many, many of his students, often quite problematically? And one of the things that you say is that the incidence of this within at least American Buddhism, the percentage, if you sort of try to run the numbers on this any way that the numbers can possibly run, it looks as though this happens within this world, within this community more often than it happens in other places. Is that part of the takeaway?
We're talking about a small sample size, but it is interesting to note that of the 3 to 4 dozen leading Zen centers in the United States, about a quarter of them have had a major leader who has had sexual scandal, not just sex with a student, but in a way that proved scandalous when it came out. So that's worth noting. The takeaways, I think, would be two. One is that people should not idealize any tradition, religious, philosophical, spiritual, whatever. If you're looking for the best people, they're scattered among traditions and in no traditions and in secularism, right? But it's not the case that if you go to the Friends Meeting House that the Quakers will all be the best people, or the Unitarians or the Buddhists or the yoga practitioners. There are bad people everywhere. And then the second takeaway would be that there is a specific kind of silence that obtained in this sort of guru-centered model where nobody seemed able to dethrone him because they just couldn't see what their community would be like without him. And so the women were dismissed and mistreated, and some of the women kind of dismissed and mistreated their own voices as well.
You know, Jay Michelson, listening to this and reading Mark's book, I mean, one of the parallels that I made immediately, I spent a lot of time pretty intensely involved in the world of yoga, and obviously yoga has almost exact parallel scandals, whether it's John Friend or Rodney Yee or Amrit Desai, who founded Kripalu, or Swami Muktananda, even Bikram Chaudhary, although his is still kind of at the level of complaint. We don't know what kind of case that is. But there are really, really similar scandals. And one of the other things that the one of the other parallels is that these traditions both are understood to be best practiced in conjunction with, in the presence of, a really good teacher, to whom one listens very carefully. Could we just kind of run our thumb down that knife's edge for a moment? Because obviously in a situation like this, teachers get very powerful. You know, maybe they do things like this. On the other hand, the way that I understand both of these traditions is that they need teachers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, progressive yoga and meditation communities are really wrestling and struggling with that issue. There are a number of alternative models that are being explored, you know, where there's more peer learning and where there are teachers who are experts. After all, you know, they have expertise in something, but they're not seen as some sort of all-wise guru who's going to control every part of your life. And that does, you know, certainly that runs in tension with the guru traditions that exist within, whether it's yoga or Zen Buddhism. But, you know, we should remember that the kind of yoga and meditation that people are practicing in the United States is like the reform of a reform of a reform already. So, you know, D.T. Suzuki was just talked about in the last segment, you know, was a reformer educated by other reformers. And so we're already in a case where what was being practiced on the Upper East Side is kind of Zen for export. It is different from what's practiced in Japan. First of all, it's practiced by lay people, not just by monks. And so we're already in a case where the traditions have been adapted widely. So there are a lot of voices saying that one of the ways we should keep adapting is to kind of divest ourselves of this notion that you need some guru.
But can I ask both of you something, since you've both had more guru experience than I have, which is, isn't something lost? I mean, in the little encounters that I've had with gurus, and as a journalist, having seen people in encounter with lots of guru-type leaders, I mean, there's a kind of profundity and a kind of that comes from encountering someone with a lot of charisma and turning over a certain part of oneself to that other person. So, I mean, something will be lost, right?
Yeah, you know, Jay, maybe another way to ask that question is, you know, Mark talks a lot in the ebook about the notion of authority. Where does authority come from? You know, where do you get these ideas and from that you invest with validity if you're going to say that the guru-centric model is going to implode of its own accord?
Yeah, I mean, I think the authority comes really from pragmatic grounds and experience, like what actually works. And you know, so for example, there's a community now online. There are a couple of them called, one's called Dharma Overground, like instead of underground. And people are just sharing online what their experiences are. And the cream rises to the top based not on charisma, but on efficacy. You know, does this actually work? I mean, the reason why I'm interested in Buddhist practice is not, you know, the trappings and the exoticism and stuff like that. It's because it actually, for me, has lessened my own suffering. Like, it's made me happier and made me less of a jerk. So those criteria, rather than sort of the woo-woo stuff of a charismatic leader, for me, are really what it's about. And, you know, in terms of what's lost, yeah, I think what's lost is that. You know, I think that, you know, that idea that I'm going to fall under the spell of some teacher with a lot of charisma, you know, that's value neutral, right? There's all kinds of pretty evil political and religious cult leaders and everybody who, you know, charisma is definitely ethically neutral at best.
There's a certain kind of ecstasy, a particular quality of ecstasy that comes under the spell of a charismatic leader. But there's a downside. There's a flip side as well. That's all I was saying.
And I also think there's a notion that teachers get you to do certain things better. You know, there's, you know, and I think better probably is a pretty problematic word within the Buddhist tradition. But there is such a thing as better. You know, there is such a thing as growth and improvement and progress on the path to enlightenment. And so you want to get there, right? And teachers help you get there.
Yeah, teachers or what, you know, there's a Buddhist term, kalyanamitta, spiritual friend. And having one of those or a set of those is really helpful. So, again, I'll pick another emerging Buddhist community, which is one called Buddhist Geeks, which, as the name implies, is like a lot of, like, tech nerds and stuff like that. And they're very wired in. And these are people who grew up with open source software and with circular communities. They're not about to surrender authority to any kind of, you know, leader or authority figure. And yet, of course, there's a space for experts and for teachers because they know stuff that you don't know. Just like if you're learning how to program in C++, you want to be with somebody who's a better programmer than you. But that's very different from this charismatic notion. And, you know, I've been with charismatic teachers, many of them, and some are good, some are wise, and some are evil. I mean, really, you know, people are really abusive, and it doesn't matter. That doesn't track onto how much charisma they have.
All right, we're going to have to stop right there, although it would be interesting to explore Oppenheimer's notions of which decentralized religious communities with very little in the way of authority figures have worked. I don't know, maybe Quakers, something like that. I don't know. We'll have to do that another day. Thanks very much to Jay Michelson. Thanks to Mark Oppenheimer. Thanks apostrophically to Dr. Brian Victoria. Thanks to all of you for listening, too. Email us at colin@wnpr.org.
Zen.
In 20 feet, follow your bliss. No, seriously, it's right there. 42 Nothingness Avenue. You are always at your destination.